Hi, Andy.
Hi, Victoria.
Today we have Amita Nathwani, who is an Ayurvedic practitioner, and she actually teaches in our fellowship program.
Great. Well, this was an ancient system of medicine that is not really well known in the West, and I'm delighted that we're beginning to teach it.
Me too. And I'm particularly interested in the Panchakarma, which is their detoxification practices. So let's get her on.
Okay.
Amita Nathwani is an Ayurvedic medicine practitioner and educator. She's been in practice for more than 20 years and studied at the Maharishi School of Ayurveda. Amita comes from a family of Western doctors and is inspired to bridge the gap between traditional and contemporary medical systems. She's also on our fellowship faculty at the Andrew Weil Center for Integrative Medicine at the University of Arizona. Welcome, Amita.
Thank you so much for having me today.
So, Amita, I love the title of your new book, Ayurveda, Breaking the Rules Without Breaking the Principles. Tell us what this means.
Thank you for asking. I relate to this in terms of my journey with Ayurvedic medicine. When I first started studying, I was very much encouraged and motivated to learn authentic Ayurveda in its traditional way, the way that it was practiced 5,000 years ago. I wanted to bring forth all of that empirical, evidence-based medicine that we saw that we were able to bring into our medical system today and relate it to individuals. I wanted to bridge that gap. And then about 8 years into my practice, I had a personal tragedy. I lost my husband very suddenly in a car accident. And I always say there was the day that I chose Ayurveda, and then there was the day that Ayurveda chose me. Because after that, I decided that I could not practice Ayurveda in the same way I had before. The do's and the do nots, the strict way that we bring forth our daily lifestyle, our dinacharya, what we call meditation, pranayam, what time to wake up, what to eat, what not to do. None of those things applied because in that moment, I understood that I couldn't do any of those things, even if they were the right thing. And my compassion for every patient that I had before grew exponentially when I realized that we can't just blanketly say that everybody should do the same thing, or these are the principles of Ayurveda and this is how we apply it. So from that day onward, I really started delving deeper into the principles. And I really learned that actually it's not a strict system of health. It takes into consideration all of these things, the individual person, where they live, what they eat, what their experiences are, their genetic predisposition, and trauma. It's all there. It's just that when we want to learn something, we always sort of learn it on that superficial level, without really taking its principles and then breaking those rules so that then we can apply it to ourselves in this day and this time. And that inspired my book. So nothing I wrote, I remember my teacher hearing about the title of my book and he sort of gasped. And then he actually read the book and he said, you're still talking about Ayurveda, but you're just bringing it into a different time and place now.
Beautiful. I have to say, one of the things that I find remarkable about Ayurveda is that centuries ago, there was this recognition of the importance of emotional health and the impact of trauma, and even the awareness that these could potentially be sources of what are called toxins, actually, in Ayurveda, and that there would be an approach to help reduce these toxins in addition to the more common ones that we're aware of, like physical toxins or emotional toxins or food is toxic sometimes.
So yes, exactly. We have a particular approach in Ayurveda. It's called Panchakarma, and it's like a detoxification technique that we do, but it's oftentimes recognized as being something that is related to simply chronic disorders or environmental pathogens. But one of the things that we were starting to recognize more and more is that it's really useful in the toxicity we have through stress and trauma. We see it. In fact, there was a study done in 2016 by the Chopra Center, and they did a study with 65 healthy adults and measured the outcomes of systemic inflammation in the body. And they found that those who had gone through the Panchakarma techniques over 6 days, actually, we started to see more and more systemically that they were feeling more relaxed and happier, and we were able to actually measure that. So it's so beautiful to see how much something that we do on a physiological level can impact us on an emotional level.
I'd like to make a nitpicking comment, and then I have a question. I hear a lot of doctors say Ayurveda, and it bothers me. It's Ayurveda. One of the Vedas, these are the ancient texts, is called the Ayurveda. So it's A-Y-U-R, not A-R-U. The other thing, I have experienced Panchakarma in India. I was at an Ayurvedic spa in South India, although Ayurveda originated in North India. But I went through the Panchakarma technique. I love the massages, of course, and the steams, but some of the techniques, I didn't do this, but one of the techniques that's used in Panchakarma is bleeding. And in India, that's often done with leeches or venesection. Clearly, that's not going to fly in the West. Another was one morning began by drinking a glass, I think it was about 8 ounces of ghee, which I really had to grit my teeth and do. That goes against all my principles. But one of the question I have is that the Indian government has tried to urge collaboration of all the different systems of medicine that are practiced there, which is great. But I think allopathic medicine in India really holds Ayurveda in contempt. It's completely dismissed by allopathic doctors. It's mostly medicine of the uneducated and poor. And in this country, my experience is that since most of the immigration from India to this country has been from highly educated classes, it's been engineers and physicists and medical doctors. In this country also, I think Ayurveda is looked down upon by many educated people and many medical doctors. And I wonder, what do you see as the possibilities for integrating some aspects of Ayurveda with conventional medicine?
Yeah, that's a great question. We are seeing a change now. It's happening, and more, it's consumer-driven, really. When we have patients who are coming to us, and whether it's myself who practices Ayurveda, but my colleagues tell me all the time, they say, I had a patient who came in and they want to take this Ayurvedic medicine and I don't know how to apply it. They've read the research on it and I hear it's really good, but I don't know what to do. What are the contraindications with what I'm already doing? And I get dozens of those calls on a weekly basis. And what that tells me is that patients are starting to really ask their doctors to step up and learn about other modalities and start integrating them into their own practices. And I mean, we have great studies now specifically on the botanicals that came from India, like ashwagandha and turmeric, but really starting to see it as a whole system of health. It's still separated. There's mindfulness, there's breathing techniques, pranayama. How to put all of these things together, that I think is going to be the biggest challenge. Because initially, I think we can find ways to be able to substantiate all the techniques. But how do we really bring that into the whole system and call it Ayurveda instead of calling it breathing techniques or stretching or oral care in the way that we do today?
And another practical question is when to refer to Ayurveda. I have seen it be most successful with lifestyle diseases, with conditions like asthma, allergies, autoimmune diseases, coronary artery disease, hypertension. I've seen really good results from people that have used Ayurveda for that. But I think that's one thing to try to teach Western-trained doctors is when you might consider referring a patient to Ayurvedic treatment.
Yeah, exactly. And we talk about disease stages in Ayurveda as well. So there are the accumulations of toxins, as we talked about earlier, that slowly build up in the body that result into a chronic disease. And if we're able to see that on a symptomatic level early on, it's easier to be able to make those corrections versus later when the disease process has fully manifested.
And you know this, and Amita, you may as well, but we have many of our fellows in integrative medicine who are of East Indian heritage. And they often were trained deeply in conventional medicine, and they found something was missing. And then they began to think, my grandmother used to give me this tea, or she used to recommend this remedy. And they begin to learn what is really part of a traditional system that was part of their heritage and use it quite deeply.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. I was just mentioning the other day about how many of the students who come through the fellowship program who are from India talk to me quite a bit about how can they bridge that gap? Because for them, they have that deep understanding of Ayurveda from their heritage, but clinically, they practice conventional medicine, and they've never been able to put the two together or contend with it. They're not really sure how to substantiate one or the other, or even make those translations. And one of the issues I think that we've really had the uphill battle in Ayurveda is that because the texts are written in Sanskrit, translation of pathophysiology from Ayurveda into conventional medicine has been very difficult to do. And admittedly, I take a lot of liberties. All my professors tell me that I take a lot of liberties, but in order to fully be able to explain this process, we have to be able to find those that correlating language. And I think that's the place we're coming to in our society today is, are we coming together to speak the same language? Are we here for our patients? Or are we still going to continue to be separated by needing it to be the right way or keeping the purity of the knowledge? How do we do that and still bring it to a place where it can be applied for everyone? And that's the challenge we have now.
One of the things that I discovered in studying Ayurveda is that there's a surgical branch of Ayurveda historically. And I once visited the Benares Hindu University in Varanasi, which has on its campus an allopathic medical school, a homeopathic medical school, an Ayurvedic medical school, very unusual. I went to the Ayurvedic medical school, to the surgery clinic, and watched an anal fistula repair. One of the things that I read about, which is fascinating, is that many of the plastic surgery techniques used today were developed in India hundreds of years ago. And one of the there was a period in India where women who were found guilty of infidelity had their noses cut off. So there was a reconstruction technique using a facial flap that is still in use today for nose reconstruction and facial reconstruction developed by Ayurvedic physicians in India centuries ago.
Absolutely, you're correct. His name, the surgeon who developed this, his name was Shushrut Sangita, his technique, and it is skin grafting. And to date, actually, if you look at any conventional plastic surgery textbook, homage is given to Shushrut for this particular technique. Great. I love that story that it was, some people say the noses would get cut off of thieves and beggars, and some people say infidelity, but yeah. The point
is noses were cut off.
Noses were cut off.
I do have to say that one of the things I find most remarkable about Ayurveda is the Panchakarma, because I think that of all the different systems, traditional systems of medicine that I'm aware of, it has the most deeply thought through processes for ridding the body of toxins. So I'm wondering if you would talk a bit about that from your perspective and maybe from what is done here in the US, because I think Andy's right. We don't do leeches here. And I'm not even sure, for example, if the nasal medicines or the purging is used in the same way. I'd just love to hear from you. What do you practice? What does it look like?
So it's an area. There are eight branches of Ayurveda, and Panchakarma is one specific area. And for those of us who go through school, we have to learn all of them, but you can specialize in one area or the other. So there are Panchakarma clinics around the U.S. And let me talk a little bit about what is entailed in Panchakarma, the whole idea and concept of it. So really what we're looking at is there's the accumulation of those toxins in the body, and we want to get to the point where we can help to release that. And Ayurveda specifically notes that there are two types of quote-unquote toxins, and they're hydrophilic and lipophilic. And hydrophilic toxins can be eliminated through sweating and through the urine, but the lipophilic ones have to be treated from an internal perspective. And this is where Dr. Weil mentioned drinking the ghee. What we do is we're literally loosening some of what is building up in the body so we can finally do a purge. So pancha means five and karma means actions. So there are five ways that we eliminate toxins from the body. And they are through the nasal passages, through purgation, right? The drinking of big ghee or what have you. Enemas, bloodletting, as Dr. Weil had talked about with leeches. And finally is emesis or vomiting. And it's through the up through the esophageal area. So there are these five ways that we remove toxins from the body. But in order to do that, and it's like anything else that we do, anytime we're pulling something out, we're aggravating the tissues or the doshas or the dhatus of the body. And so that increases vata or that instability. And the body will always want to go back to homeostasis. So just doing an eliminatory process is not enough. What we have to do is literally change the inherent way that the pathways of the body functions with in order to create a system where we can eliminate without aggravating it to try to come back to the place it was before. And these are all the beautiful, luxurious treatments we get prior to eliminatory ones that feel good, like the massages and the sweats. And even in some cases, taking in some oils, like when we do enemas, we will always do a restorative enema first with oil to hold before we do the eliminatory enema to release. And this is the way that we can help to kind of change the way the body's responding to us removing things without it creating a constricting quality to maintain that same process of disease we were used to being in. And that's what makes panchakarma, this particular type of detoxification, so unique. And it can't be done in one day. We do it over a period of time. So 7, 14, 21 days. To date, my parents still go to India every year and they go for panchakarma and they stay for 7 or 14 days. And it's a way to really get back in touch with your body, even through lifestyle, right? Through beautiful, healthy food prepared, you're in meditation, pranayama, you're getting rest away from society with all the stressors. If you're in the middle of doing everything, exposed to toxins, and environmental pollutants, then there's no point in going through this process because you're just continuously recreating the same disease. So this is what makes panchakarma so beautiful.
So in the U.S., how is this adapted? At the spa that I was at in Mysore, a number of the massages that I had were done by six people working on me simultaneously, which was fabulous. But I don't think that would be affordable in the U.S.
There are some places here that have two people working on you at the same time. And so that still exists. The only two techniques that are really tough to practice, we do purgation, we do enemas, we do nasal therapy. Those are safe. We have the tools and techniques to be able to do that. Even we talked about surgical techniques. We've learned how to remove polyps from the nasal passages. Again, somewhat archaic and medieval, but effective. But the two techniques we don't do is leeching and emesis. Mm-hmm. And two of those are more difficult to do here in the United States. So we do find alternative ways of providing those. I, for one, will recommend patients go to traditional Chinese medicine practitioners because it's through needling that they can do some bloodletting. It's not the same as leeches. They don't come to the lymph nodes and pump the lymphatic system that way, but we still are able to do that to a certain extent. Chelation therapy, people giving blood on occasion, I'll recommend that. So there are ways that we work with it, but the typical traditional way of doing panchakarma is best done in facilities that can provide all of those techniques.
And who would you recommend it for? Where are the indications?
So first, let me tell you who it's not recommended for. Oftentimes, if one has weakness or debilitation in those who are too young or too old, also, for those who are underweight, the inherent idea of cleansing is removing. And so when we're removing anything from the body, we want to ensure that we're also not debilitated, further removing from anyone who needs to build instead. So in those cases, we would do what's called rasayana, which is bringing in and building the body up. So those are cases where we would be more cautioned. Chronic diseases and disorders are really the primary place where we will start to refer patients for Panchakarma. In traditional Ayurveda, it is something that people just go to yearly, just for general yearly cleansing, like my parents do. So for us, what I recommend is if we're eating well and we're exercising, just making note of the rejuvenative qualities that we're looking for within ourselves. We do want to perform some of these processes, but not necessarily all five of them, because then they are disease oriented. So for blood disorders, we will focus more on that rakta moksha, that bloodletting. Or for those who do have a tendency toward GI disorders, we're going to look more at doing enemas or purgation.
Andy, I always love your first rule of detoxification, which I think is worth bringing forth in this conversation.
That is, stop putting toxins in. So really become aware of the toxic elements in your environment, everything you're in contact with, your food, the water you drink, and do your best to minimize intake of toxins.
And sometimes you even talk about those emotional toxins.
Absolutely, yeah.
You talk about a news fast. I wonder about some of what you're describing, Amita, being gained from going to some beautiful resort for a week and letting go of some of your responsibilities and taking daily walks and eating healthy food as a maybe more typical American version of what your parents are doing.
Yeah. And I mean, this really comes down to, why are we getting away to do these things? Why can't we bring them into our life today? My area of specialty in Ayurveda is digestive disorders and psychiatry. And I really like approaching who we are, what we're doing, from that place of truly asking ourselves, what do we want in the world? What is it that we're looking for? Who do we want to be? How do we want to show up? And we have to start with those questions. We have to get to know ourselves first before we can even begin the process of trying to be healthy and happy, because we have to identify what that means. And for most of us, it means just that, just what you said, Dr. Weil. It's those emotional toxins that really infiltrate into our entire being, the way we think, the way that we believe, how it is that we choose our words and our actions. This all comes from within. And that type of cleansing is a daily practice. And for some people, it's through meditation. And for other people, it's through exercise. And for other people, it's just being with who they are. Whatever that is, I encourage my patients and everyone that it has to start with us, especially healthcare providers. It's a really big question when we're trying to care for others. The first thing that we have to do is make sure our cup is full so it really flows over. And then compassion is not something that we're trying. It's just coming out because we're doing it for ourselves already. And if we can build that into our lives, and it's hard for some people. This is why I have the Breaking the Rules book. I'm not going to ask a mother of three to do a 1 hour asana practice every morning just to create union of mind and body. There are other ways that we can start to just doing some internal examination. And this psycho-spiritual approach is really the foundation of Ayurvedic medicine for whatever it looks like for whomever is doing it.
That's quite beautiful. I think one of the places that Western medicine struggles is with the integration of spirituality into a medical practice. And you just gave one lovely example. I'm wondering if you could speak about that a little bit more.
Yeah, I think one of the things also that needs to be recognized, we can look at it in so many different ways. We can talk about it in terms of cultural competency if we want to, religion. What we really all need to do is understand that we're all coming from a different place in life. We didn't come from the same place. We're not doing the same things. And even the judgment on food in our culture today has become so great. I have to tell this story because it's one of my favorite stories to tell about I have a medicine man in my life. And I met him living in Colorado. So when I first moved to Colorado, I called my teacher in India and I said, this place is so weird. Everybody... so much meat and drinks a lot of beer. And my teacher asked me one question. He said, what's the elevation? And I said, well, it's about 6,500 feet above sea level. And he says, oh, yes, they're practicing Ayurveda. He said, are they eating pork and goat? And I said, well, similar, like elk and venison. And he said, of course. He said, you're not going to be foraging for mung beans and rice in the middle of winter in Colorado. And then he said, are they drinking the ale with the flowers? And I was thinking, what are you talking about? Hops.
Hops.
Bitter quality to help break down all of those saturated fats. And in that moment, I learned our judgment on who should do what and when they should do it and how they shouldn't. So I found that I met this medicine man I told you about, and through ceremony, he processes elk. And so he gave me little bits of elk. And when I lived in Colorado in the middle of winter, I would eat a little bit to make sure that I was also living in harmony with my own environment. And when we talk about spirituality, we can talk about meditation. We can talk about God if we want. We can talk about consciousness. But true spirituality comes from that place where we really understand who we are in this world and with our environment and nature. And each other. And if we can have that connection with humanity, then we are practicing spirituality.
That was a great story. I taught for many years at a Tibetan Buddhist retreat center in Colorado called the Shambhala Mountain Center. I was always surprised by how much meat Tibetan Buddhists ate. And I how could this be? They don't even kill a fly. If there's a mosquito in the room, they try and shoo it out instead of killing it. And yet they eat meat. And I think the story you just told, I mean, that's the food that was available when you were up in the Himalayas.
One of our friends just passed away, as you know, and she had a lot of connections with the Tibetan community and would often have groups of Tibetan monks come in. And someone I know who cooked for her told me that when the Tibetan monks were here, all they wanted to do was drink Coca-Cola and eat beef.
Yeah, there's also a great story about Maharshi Mahesh Yogi, a teacher of meditation. He once had a place where people would go so that they could meditate year-round and all the time. One of the things that happens is that when we're in that place of meditation all the time and we're not here in the world, we become very ungrounded. And so bringing in foods that are denser in quality is really important. So from an Ayurvedic medicine perspective, we would talk about it being vata aggravation, and we need to create that groundedness. And there's a story of someone who was meditating for about a year straight with this teacher and actually just lost it and was unable to communicate and was talking in circles. And he was in the United States at the time. So they called the teacher across the ocean and said, we don't know what to do with him. He's really ungrounded. And he said, take him for a drive in the city and give him fried chicken. So they took Kentucky Fried Chicken and he ate that and became much more grounded. So again, we have to take into consideration what our environment is and what we're doing and have compassion for ourselves and what our needs are. Spontaneously following our desires is actually really important. If we have a level of balance within ourselves, I think we inherently all know what we need.
So how does someone in the United States find someone who is trained well in Ayurveda if they're intrigued and want to pursue this approach?
Yes. So, you know, really like anybody, you know, I have to do my research when I'm looking for any healthcare provider, right? I want to know how long they've been in practice and where they've been educated. So in India, the training is called BAMS, and this is a Bachelor's of Ayurvedic Medicine and Surgery. And so those individuals are trained classically and then clinically. Here in the U.S., so many people from India will come here with their BAMS. It's a little harder to practice here with that. Sometimes there needs to be an adjunct degree to go with it. So there are master's degree programs that are also available to those in India and those who are here. So usually what I let people know is make sure that the person that you're going to see has some experience in practicing Ayurveda, has studied for at least 4 to 6 years, because our traditional training is not just in Ayurveda, but we need to learn anatomy, physiology, some of the basic concepts of understanding how it is that the body works. Unfortunately, because Ayurveda is not regulated here in the U.S., like traditional Chinese medicine is, and there's accreditation for that, It can be a little tough because there are 1 year and 2 year programs available. And you just want to be able to talk to your provider and make sure that they have the experience. And as I say this, I also oftentimes in the back of my mind, remember that that's how we look at it today in order for us to really validate the medicine. But at one time, this was just an oral tradition. And it was passed down from generation to generation, and the training was a lifelong journey. And so, however, at this time you can look at it, it's really important to really investigate. There are organizations here in the U.S., NAMA, the National Ayurveda Medical Association in particular, does board certify individuals who have gone through the training so that there can be some affiliation, and that's a really good place to start as well.
This has been a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for sharing your experience and your wisdom, and thank you for teaching in our fellowship program.
Yes, indeed.
Thank you. And I just want to thank you, both of you, Dr. Mazes and Dr. Weil, because of the work that you've done to set the foundation, we can bring Ayurvedic medicine more and more into academia and conventional medicine and give doctors who are interested in learning more the opportunity to do so. So thank you very much for everything that you do.